Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
I'm Sarah Posner. I'm senior editor at Religion Dispatches, and I'm here today again with Sarah Wildman. She's a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, a columnist for PBS, and a regular contributor to The New York Times, Slate, The Guardian, and many other publications. Today, we're going to be talking about U.S.-Israel policy, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and in particular, how that gets talked about by American Jews and Israeli Jews. And we're going to talk about in the course of that Sarah's piece from a couple of weeks ago in The Nation about the Israeli web magazine 972.
Okay, great. And actually, it's on the newsstand still now. It's the March 5th through 12th issue. So
great.
While we in the web world think of it as being out for a week or two already, it's actually still on the newsstand.
Right. Yeah, so I read it on the web. But even though I do have a subscription to The Nation, but somehow I end up reading everything on the web because I have to read it instantly. So
no, I'm the same way. But nevertheless,
nevertheless, everybody read it. Okay.
Right.
So, but I wanted to start with, so, you know, this week, as everybody knows, is the AIPAC conference. And President Obama spoke yesterday to the AIPAC delegates. And I guess the Republican candidates are speaking to them today or tomorrow. But I wanted to start us off with, you know, because I don't want to go too deep in the weeds on the whole AIPAC stuff, because
right.
I wanted to discuss this ad that was taken out in the New York Times last week by the Emergency Committee for Israel
mm-hmm.
and what it was based on and what that says about the state of our ability to talk about Israel-Palestine issues in a rational way.
Right.
So for people who don't know, the Emergency Committee for Israel took out an ad in the New York Times last week accusing the Center for American Progress and Media Matters, which are two liberal, avowedly liberal organizations.
Mm-hmm. But distinct, which we should probably point
and distinct, right, two different mm-hmm. organizations, of being anti-Israel.
Right.
And it called on the readers of the New York Times to call the funders of these organizations who's, you know, who have both CAP and Media Matters have files on foreign policy, but the bulk of what they do is not related to foreign policy or even to Israel-Palestine issues. I think probably most people know Media Matters for its watchdog work on Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And probably most people know CAP for its work on, you know, immigration reform and reproductive rights. And they've been covering the contraception debate. So this is not the main focus of either organization's mission. But nonetheless, the ad provided phone numbers of funders for both organizations, urged
right.
people to call those funders. And contained quotes about the organizations from people who said after the ad appeared that they were not consulted. Those people included Alan Dershowitz,
right.
Who wrote in the foreword that he was shocked to see his name on the advertisement on an advertisement that I do not support. And Spencer Ackerman, who's a national security reporter, who wrote a piece for the web magazine Tablet about the use of the term Israel Firster.
Right.
He got quoted in the ad, and he was not consulted and did not give his consent to being quoted in the ad. And
mm-hmm.
the ad has been the subject of a lot of criticism. Jane Eisner, the editor of The Forward, said in a piece on the website, The Forward website, "I opened my New York Times this morning over breakfast to read one of the most virulent anti-Jewish advertisements I've ever seen, and it came from other Jews."
Right.
So the backstory on all of this is a piece that was written by Ben Smith, who's at the time was still at Politico,
right.
Which discussed alleged concerns by some conservatives that these two liberal organizations were disseminating anti-Israel and anti-Semitic diatribe.
And were diverging from what's considered mainstream political thinking in Washington, in particular, around Israel and Israel policy. I think that that's a big piece of it. And I just want to quibble with one thing. I do think that actually CAP has gotten into foreign policy pretty deeply,
mm-hmm.
and that's part of the reason why this was triggered. And, you know, we sort of need to distinguish between a few things. One, the ad was aimed at CAP and Media Matters, but actually the quibbling, and it's more than quibbling, but the argument is with Think Progress. And I think we need to sort of distinguish between CAP and Think Progress.
And Think Progress is a blog that's hosted by the Center for American Progress.
Right. And I think that that's part of the issue as well, which is about kind of a hosted journalistic outlet. That's
and to be clear about Media Matters, Media Matters hosts a blog called Political Correction,
right.
which there are several contributors to it, but one of them is MJ Rosenberg, who frequently uses the term Israel First. They're mostly on Twitter, I think. Occasionally has used it, maybe once or twice. I did a web search on the Media Matters site. It was twice he used that term there, but I think has used it elsewhere. He blogs elsewhere as well.
Well, I cut you off, though, and let's do break down how this sort of came about. So in the beginning of December, there was this piece by Ben Smith in Politico, which kind of narrated a division between CAP and Media Matters for America and what they saw as sort of mainstream Democratic Party thinking, Democratic Big D thinking.
Well, what conservatives saw as that there was a divergence between these groups and mainstream thinking, I think, is a subject of debate.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And then it was discovered by, it was published in Salon, there were a bunch of pieces in Salon, that Josh Block, who was a former AFAC spokesman, was putting forward what they called opposition research, but really was sort of a, you know, and you could say that, but it wasn't anything that was sort of subterranean. What he'd done was a compilation of kind of quotes and narratives that he had pulled that he felt underscored what was a split in some way, that wasn't mainstream on Israel, that was moving towards an allegedly anti-Israel position. And in his sort of cover was that he himself was a Democrat and that he served in the Clinton administration. And so therefore he was sort of offering this up, but he was pushing it to people, asking them to promote this widely. And that was seen as in some ways, you know, nefarious. It was seen as an attack, and it launched a kind of back and forth, which has gone on in the blogosphere. I mean, now we're in the beginning of March, the start of the beginning of December. It's a long time for this sort of thing to go on. And really it broke down around a couple of things. One was, what was the position of Camp and Media Matters and their individual bloggers on their blogs and websites around Israel policy?
And I think that there's been an unfortunate conflation of the two organizations without an adequate breaking out, like who said what and who hosted what and who apologized for what.
Right. And I also think that there was this other piece of it, which was about what had been said by individual Twitter account, individuals on their Twitter accounts. And that's an interesting other piece, which is something we can kind of think about.
Yeah,
and
I think we're going to talk about Twitter quite a bit today.
No, exactly. And I think that there, and basically it started to become nastier and nastier and nastier. It was picked up by the Washington Post. It was picked up by Commentary, which isn't so surprising, but Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post. Right. And what these...
I think there was also a reported piece in the Washington Post about the whole incident.
That was much later, though. That actually didn't come out until the beginning or middle of February.
Oh, right. Okay. But at the time, back in December, this was going on, right?
Back in December, what started to happen was you got Jennifer Rubin on her blog on the Washington Post website and others. And Jennifer Rubin is, of course,
a conservative blogger.
Right. And what conservative bloggers started to do was get quotes, which brings us back to the Emergency Committee on Israel, to get quotes from mainstream major American Jewish organizations to say that the statements on Think Progress and by Twitter accounts by Think Progress bloggers and statements by Media Matters writers were anti-Semitic. And were peddling in anti-Semitic tropes, and they started really throwing around that term. Actually, around this time, maybe you saw it, around this time I wrote a piece for The Forward. I mean, after this had kind of been going on for a couple of weeks, I wrote a piece for The Forward talking about how I felt that this was – I actually didn't break it down really individually, and I didn't go into Josh Block himself. I didn't go into a lot of name-calling because I didn't want to kind of get down into that mud. Unfortunately, in the current environment, it's almost impossible not to, and my words were sort of taken out of context myself, but basically saying that we have to be really careful with the term anti-Semitic. We have to be really careful with the term anti-Semitism, and that we were losing sight of what was happening in the mainstream, in the organizations themselves, on their blogs themselves, and on the Twitter accounts of individuals, but also saying that what we're seeing here is a reevaluation of Israel policy in the Democratic Party and in areas which are seen as mouthpieces for the Democratic Party, and not even in a really particularly radical way, just a sort of, you know, relatively careful looking at, you know, is all of the policy that we're advancing, is it, you know, what we want to be doing, you know, is right. Israel policy, and in fact, Center for American Progress, let's say, to start with them for a moment, they've been very, very careful about sort of using Israeli officials as their sources and kind of, you know, what they do is they tend to aggregate, right? They take things that are, you know, being published elsewhere and then they kind of do a bit of analysis around it and they kind of repackage it and put it out there for, you know, for those who aren't reading absolutely everything. And they weren't taking anything that was all that radical. The problem was, and I feel like we're going to go in circles around this, was at the same time, a couple of their bloggers had used this term Israel firster
on Twitter.
And
not
look,
in their blog.
Not in their blog, never in their blog. And I, in my piece, I talked about how I thought that, you know, calling these organizations and calling any dissent on Israel anti-Semitic is dangerous. I think that we need to be vigilant around what is anti-Semitism, because real anti-Semitism does still exist, xenophobia does still exist.
Right.
And that one, when we conflate it and we argue about it in terms of it being, you know, using Holocaust imagery the way that we started to see, we dilute and debase the term. You know, that we no longer have any impact with the term anti-Semitism if we're throwing it around.
And if I can add something on that point.
Yeah.
So the Emergency Committee for Israel, you know, so it's headed by, or the board consists of, you know, Bill Kristol, the founder of the editor of the Weekly Standard, and Gary Bauer, a religious right activist who also serves on the board of Christians United for Israel, which itself has basically made its mark by arguing that any nuclear capability, I mean nuclear capability, not nuclear weapon capability, by Iran poses, you know, a Holocaust-like threat to Israel and the Jewish people. You know, they've used language like it's 1938 all over again. They've compared Ahmadinejad to Haman and used the Purim analogy, which is, I guess, appropriate to bring up at this time of the year. I mean, you know, to that they use it inappropriately. It's appropriate to bring that up. And so, you know, these are, so that sort of use, I'm always troubled by making that comparison, because it's a scare tactic when it's not apt. It's just intended to inflame people rather than have an, a rational discussion about what to do about Iran and its interest in developing a nuclear weapon.
Right, and you've seen that in the Republican candidates as well. I mean, Newt Gingrich in particular is constantly saying that Iran will, you know, can, you know, it'll be a second Holocaust, and if three nuclear weapons, he said it yesterday actually, you know, three nuclear weapons aimed at Israel will be a second Holocaust. And it, you know, to be fair, I mean, I don't know if that's exactly what I want to say, but to be fair, you know, this is rhetoric that's coming out of Israel as well. I mean, Netanyahu has used this rhetoric of a second Holocaust, and there has been a lot of use of Holocaust analogy, and I think that it's always dangerous. I think it's pretty much always a mistake. This actually got Kappa into a bit of trouble as well. I mean, I think that there, you know, these words are twisted constantly, and so once you kind of go in that direction, I think you need to challenge it at its base. You need to say, I mean, for example, I mean, there was a moment where there was a piece that was cited quite a bit by critics of Camp on Think Progress, which said that the Simon Wiesenthal Center had called 67 Auschwitz borders. So for me, I actually think that we should challenge the Simon Wiesenthal Center on that at its very core. You know, why are we using the term Auschwitz? Why, you know, and they argue that it was used by other people. It doesn't matter. To me, I think we should just sort of unpack the entire thing and say, we should not sully the memory of Auschwitz by calling the 67 borders Auschwitz borders. We just shouldn't. You know, I think that you cannot, you can't go there. And what had happened was, you know, with this particular blog post, was that Kapp had said, by saying so, and by Obama, you know, agreeing to 67 borders, and them saying Obama is agreeing to Auschwitz borders, they said it was as though they'd likened Obama to a Nazi. And then, of course, the Wiesenthal Center freaked out and said, we never called him a Nazi. I actually think that this is a case of where the rhetoric should have just been taken apart from the beginning. You know, you should never have even gotten down into the back and forth. But I think it's sort of, so you have these two issues. One is the nitty-gritty, which, you know, you can kind of tease apart and gets very insider baseball. And then the other is the larger point, which is, where is criticism for Israel acceptable and where it's not?
Right.
And to a large degree, this is about policing ideas around Israel and policing what we're allowed to talk about and what's happening on the ground in Israel versus what we package for domestic consumption in the United States. And that's really what you see from the Republican candidates here. And I think that what's disturbing about this that's been going on since December is that there has been a shift in the way that the Think Progress blog, for example, and I'm not Media Matter a little bit less so, at least in terms of individuals, but there's certainly been a much more careful writing style and I think a lessening of a kind of fair critique, or at least fair, get this out there and let's discuss what's happening in terms of Israel since this all began, because of the relationship between Kapp and the Democratic Party. Right. And because that everybody is concerned about Obama for re-election. I mean, granted, given the way the Republican primaries have gone, you know, it's hard to feel that Obama has a real, you know,
never be complacent.
No, but you can't be complacent. Right, exactly. And obviously Obama, for whatever reason, I mean, Jeff Goldberg the other day from The Atlantic, who just sat down with Obama last week, tweeted, you know, that Obama could circumcise himself and become a Lubavitcher and he'd still be called an Israel basher in certain circles. I mean, there's a certain crowd that has decided that Obama is not in Israel's camp and they will, you know, they'll go on that.
Right. And this is the aim of the Emergency Committee for Israel ad.
Right.
They're against Obama. They want to drive a wedge between Obama and these organizations that are seen as being in the Obama camp or having a relationship with the Democratic Party cap at Media Matters.
Right.
And create the impression not only that is Obama insufficiently supportive of Israel and insufficiently supportive of the longstanding friendship between the United States and Israel, but that the entire, there's this innuendo that the entire Democratic apparatus is in that sort of untrustworthy camp.
Right.
So I think that the Emergency Committee for Israel ad can't, it obviously cannot be seen as, oh, you know, there are people who are quote unquote pro-Israel and they're very concerned about this, you know, anti-Semitism. You have to see it in the political context that these are people who are loyal to the Republican Party taking aim at these very significant liberal organizations inside the Beltway.
Right. And they're taking them down at a point of, at something that's really almost, you know, it's sacrosanct, right? I mean, it's something that is impossible to argue around, and it's become this kind of, you know, name your cliche. It's become a third rail of American politics. I mean, I think that that's actually sort of the irony of it, which is that there, you know, this argument from, you know, Mike Huckabee has not been in today's USA Today saying that he was in Israel recently, and there are still people with tattoos on their arms who know that another Holocaust could be coming, and there should be no daylight between the United States and Israel on any policy issues. Compared to the rest of the world, there is no daylight between us and Israel on policy issues. That said, you know, between close friends, there can be a critical conversation about what the policy on Iran should be going forward, and, you know, a policy of, you know, sanctions and after we've been through, you know, 11 years of war. I mean, it's, you know, the idea of going into a war, you know, dancing to the drumbeat of these war drums is a little bit terrifying, I think, to most people.
Talking
most
about
Iran.
People.
On Iran, yeah. And I think that this stuff around that Israel's that our Israel policy on both Iran and also on settlement building ends up becoming this litmus test for leadership in America now. And again, it's interesting. I mean, we can get into this 972 conversation if you want. But when I first sat down with Noam Shehzad, who is the editor in chief of 972, which is this online magazine and just wrote about for the Nation. Sorry if you hear I have a marine one goes over my head here. You may hear it. And here
I do hear it now.
Noam said, sorry, let's let the generals pass over our heads. Okay.
So we were just talking about war and then this marine helicopter goes over your head. Okay.
Exactly. Well, and it's funny, I hear them all the time. Sorry, I lost my thought for a second.
You're talking about 972.
Right, and you know, I think that on the settlement, I think we were talking about the settlement issue as well as Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that I totally lost my thought. But it becomes this doubled issue. Oh, so when I first sat down with Noam Shehzad, I mean, he talked about how Israel itself has become this sort of mythical place in American domestic politics now. And you and I have talked about this before. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously the constituency who cares about Israel is, of course, Jews, but it's also Christian evangelicals,
mm-hmm.
and it's also neocons, which, you know, can be mm-hmm. a mix of all sorts of people. And it has very little to do with what's happening on the ground in Israel. It has
right.
very little to do with, you know, real concerns about whether a two-state solution is possible.
Right.
And it has everything to do with a kind of constructed, almost storybook place, which doesn't look at, you know, what does a continued settlement building mean for the possibility of a two-state solution when you may be just geographically undermining that idea? What does, what does the peace process mean? And because it's all become, you know, packaged for the American population, and you see that, really, really see that in the Republican race for the presidential primaries right now.
Well, I mean, I think that the Republican position, and, you know, we talked about last time how Gingrich has, you know, changed his position on, for example, right. the example you brought up on the location of the American embassy in Israel, to suit the political moment. But something that I want to delve into a little bit more is the conversation among liberal Jews about this and this whole question of policing language and how you even get into a conversation about it. And then I think we can transition to talking about this in the context of the 972 bloggers. But
right,
I did want to talk about, going back to the context of the emergency committee ad and the Ben Smith piece, was the piece that Spencer Ackerman wrote in Tablet about the use of the term Israel Firster,
right.
which he writes has a nasty anti-Semitic pedigree. It turns out that white supremacist Willis Carto was reportedly the first to use it, and David Duke popularized it through his propaganda
mm-hmm.
network. And so Ackerman argues that Jews shouldn't use this because it's an anti-Semitic term.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that something that was unclear in Ackerman's piece was who exactly was using it. I mean, he was very clear that M.J. Rosenberg, who blogs for Media Matters, has used it. And I follow M.J. on Twitter, and he does use it quite
right.
liberally on Twitter. But something that sort of struck me from Ackerman's article was the use of the term is on the rise among Jewish progressives. And I guess my reaction to that, as someone who doesn't use the term, as a Jewish progressive who doesn't use the term,
right.
is that I would very much like to have a rational conversation about the occupation and the American relationship with Israel and so on and so forth without resorting to that. And I just wonder, like, how is that conversation going to take place? What you have these different layers or levels of where the conversation is taking place. So you have bloggers and sort of that whoever decides that they're willing to inject themselves into that very heated blogosphere kind of discussion about it, which also plays out on Twitter, which is sort of an imperfect place to have that sort of conversation
right,
because
yeah,
of the character limitation and how things
yeah.
can be misconstrued. But
right, I think people are very aggressive on Twitter.
Yeah, but that's a sort of limited number of people who are having that conversation. And granted, they may be thought leaders or pundits or opinion makers,
mm-hmm.
but I think that when the conversation spirals into this discussion of, oh, well, you know, even Jews now are using this anti-Semitic trope to talk
right.
about this issue, then I think it continues to scare people away who aren't involved in these conversations on blogs or Twitter from
mm-hmm.
having the conversation, which I think is so needs to happen. But anybody who's, you know, been to Shabbat dinner with their relatives who differ with them on this sort of thing knows how uncomfortable and heated and conversation stopping it can get.
Right.
So,
well, look, I think there's a really glaring example we can use and kind of discuss and unpack what that means. And then we can talk about, and we can also talk about the term Israel First. I mean, Sheldon Adelson, right? I mean,
yeah.
we talked about him last time. He is, I mean, the Gingrich campaign is entirely propped up by him at this point, right?
Right.
He infused the campaign with $5 million.
The super PAC,
not the campaign itself, but the super PAC, which is propping up Newt. And then, you know, Miriam, his wife, threw in another $5 million. And there were, you know, comments that he would throw in $50 million to keep Newt in the race, you know, through the super PAC because he felt that Newt had the best position on Israel. Okay, so is Sheldon Adelson an Israel firster? I mean, It does seem that he throws his money towards the candidate that he thinks supports the position on Israel that
Well,
he
he's
believes is the
admitted that that's
appropriate.
the critical thing for him.
Right.
Right.
That's what motivates him. That's his political identity. That's the candidate that he wants, the candidate that will make Israel the number one priority in American politics. I personally don't love the term Israel First. I think it's coarse. I don't think it's fantastic. I think that it's I understand why people feel that it sounds like dual loyalty canards of the 19th century, you know, in the post-emancipation era when Jews were finally sort of given real citizenship, but then were, you know, questioned constantly about whether or not they had a dual loyalty to the state and to their own identity, and then eventually, you know, in terms of Israel. The thing is I think that there's a little bit of disingenuousness going on around this, which is, you know, as a kid growing up, for me, and certainly very Zionist and conservative Jewish circles, you know, there would be these conversations. Would you serve in the IDF? You know, you'd have these conversations about if Israel and the United States went to war, whose side would you be fighting on? And, you know, kids I knew who would, you know, and not tons of them, but a handful, you know, went and served in the IDF or did Maarava, which is this kind of condensed version for foreigners. And there was a relationship with the state of Israel around, and it's complicated because, of course, we both grew up with the idea that Israel was, you know, under siege and that it was surrounded by dangerous neighbors and that we needed to stand up for it and that Israel, you know, provided a kind of security to Jews around the world, which I think many people still believe is true. And, you know, still in the beginning of it, I've just started reading Peter Beinart's book, The Crisis of Zionism, which kind of gets into this,
right.
You know, fissures in the liberal Jewish community. And he talks about how his South African, but actually Egyptian-born grandmother, you know, took enormous comfort in the existence of Israel because it meant that even though Jews were constantly on the run, there was a place to go. And I know that this is, you know, my family felt the same way. My grandfather had bank accounts in four countries because he was a Holocaust refugee. So, you know, God forbid he have to start again. You know, he knew that there was, you know, at least some cash buried in four different countries that he could get to and take out should the family have to leave. And everybody had a passport from the time they were born. You know, so there certainly is something that's infused in an anxiety in which certainly our parents were born into, and we were brought up within, even though we grew up in a post, not just post 48, you know, but we grew up in a post, you know, post major Arab Israeli war era, right? And in fact, our lives are marked.
Yeah, right, that's true. I was just
right.
My own age, but yeah.
Yeah, well, so, but in any case, I think that this is what's interesting is that we grew up with this debate in a much less fraught way, which was, what is your loyalty once Israel exists? You know, if you are an American Jew, who are you in relationship to Israel? And I think that that's something that's really come to be even more complicated now in an era where, you know, the politics of Israel's future are just much less black and white, and the occupation in the post-Intifada era makes Israeli policy very, very, very difficult for liberal-thinking people. And I think, you know, this is something that this is where we get back into the term Israel firster. So what does it mean to support Israel as the primary policy relationship of the United States? I mean, the primary foreign policy concern of the United States is, you know, look, I think that there are people who vote on single issues often. Let's say it's abortion, or let's say it's.
Or just, they're not voting on a single issue. There's an issue for which it's a deal breaker for them, right?
Right, right.
So
right, right,
there
right.
are people who are opposed to abortion who would never vote for a Democrat, even if the Democrat says, well, I want to find common ground and reduce the need for abortion, but they still can't go there. So even though they vote on, they have other concerns in addition
right.
to that, that issue is a deal breaker for them. But I just don't think, I mean, I think that that's sort of an inapt analogy that I just brought up, because I think that, you know, Jews are overwhelmingly Democratic.
Right.
And I have a hard time seeing a mass exodus to the Republican Party over Israel policy, given the, you know, sort of anti-immigrant nativism in the Republican Party, its positioning right now on reproductive issues and on gay and lesbian rights issues, and
right, the sort of inherently unfair stances on pretty much everything you can think of, from contraception to, you know, immigration. I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like a place that the Jewish. I mean, you're right, absolutely, but I do think that there are Jews who are very concerned about what or that our government be as closely identified with supporting the state of Israel, whatever the state of Israel decides to do. I think it gets into this really complicated thing, which is it always in the best interest of Israel to support exactly
right.
what the Israeli government is doing at that given moment?
And well, in my view, it's not.
Well, right.
Not.
And I think that's
and,
the thing. I mean, that's the liberal position. The liberal position is actually Israel's position on settlements is undermining its ability to remain a state going forward, that the occupation will create a you know, will at some point explode under the pressure of its own existence, you know, that it's just not.
Well, and also efforts that are made by the Israeli right in the Knesset that undermine democracy and human rights there, you know, even apart from the occupation itself. So,
right. No, on women's issues. I mean, and I think that there's, I mean, I actually think that that's something that allows American Jews to kind of get into this debate in a less fraught platform, right? Which is, you know, recently we've seen that there were concerns around buses, you know,
right,
women
right.
being asked to ride in a
women on
bus.
Buses, right.
Right.
Which seems you know, unreal. But of course, here we're having a debate about contraception, so I guess maybe not so unreal. But so, well, I mean, I guess I something I wonder about, and I think something we forgot to mention with regard to Rosenberg, M.J. Rosenberg, is that he formerly worked at AIPAC. So he comes at this from somebody who's became disaffected with
right.
the environment that he was working in. And so he's, I think he sees himself as sort of a truth teller about the reality, what he sees as the reality of what's happening here. And I think that fuels a little bit of his, I guess I would call it aggressiveness on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the reality is though, that probably most people, the universe of people who is consuming what he writes on Twitter is actually very, very small, all things considered.
Look, I think he's a little bit of a professional flamethrower, right? I
yeah.
mean, and he kind of thrives on that. And that's fine. You know, I think that there are those that do that. And unfortunately, the media environment we live in, it celebrates that, right? I mean, that's what gets attention.
But I wonder if that is impeding a conversation because nobody wants to get into this sort of flamethrowing kind of debate over this because that has been traditionally what has shut down a conversation about it, right?
That but I think that that's the issue, right? Because, okay, mm-hmm. so you have MJ Rosenberg who's decided that that's what he wants to do. Fine. Great for him.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting to me is that when I wrote the piece for The Forward, sort of say calling for civil discourse, calling for a real honest conversation that says, is, you know, differing on Israeli policy from a place of, you know, pro-Israel is a given, you know, from a place of, you know, everyone loves Israel. Let's look at what is in the best interest of Israel and the relationship of the Israel and the United States going forward. And let's not use terms like anti-Semitism. Let's not use Holocaust analogy. You know, I had a tremendous backlash on Twitter from people basically calling me a pogrom starter. And surely my parents were, you know, disappointed in me. You know, basically people calling me a self-hating Jew, all sorts of a tremendous amount of sort of ad hominem attacks on me personally. And that's what ends up happening, which is that then I think you end up sort of wanting to just withdraw from the debate. Why get into it? Why let yourself be under attack? You know who you are. I mean, do I need to sort of tick off my bona fides? I think that that's, and it's interesting because I see that Peter even does that in his own book, which is his kids go to a day school, their names are Jewish names, and they celebrate Shabbat, and his children, you know, talk about holidays. And I even think about that, in, you know, in my own context. My kid goes to a Jewish preschool. You know, we celebrate holidays. We've been talking about Purim for 2 weeks. I mean, do I need to say these things to kind of list, you know, the fact that I, you know, I speak Hebrew? I mean, do I need to say these things to be allowed to have a critical conversation about how our discourse is taking place? I mean, you don't even get to get into the actuality of the conversation, you know, because you're never allowed to progress past your corner. You know, you sort of leave the cement bags of your bunker and you're immediately hit and you run back because Do you really want to be under attack about this? Is it really
right.
worthwhile?
And I think that I get the sense that that drives Rosenberg on Twitter a little bit, like that,
mm-hmm.
that he's proud of the fact that he will not back down in the
mm-hmm.
face of that kind of criticism and that his bona fides are unassailable
right.
on these things. I mean, he points that out frequently on Twitter, and he actually defended his use of the term Israel firster and qualified it a little bit, I guess. He said, well, you know, what I mean when I use that term is that they're a Netanyahu firster. That they are supporting the Israeli right or the Israeli government, the current Israeli government, rather than, you know, that they have a loyalty to Israel that transcends their loyalty to the United States, thus, you know, leading you to question their patriotism or what
right.
have you.
I mean, I think what's interesting about it is that well, first of all, I mean, I think Twitter is just, you know, I use it and I think I've gotten better at using it, but I still don't love it. You know, I think that having to debate in 140 characters and fight in 140 characters, it just leads to coarse, broad,
unproductive.
It's yeah. I mean, and it's a tremendous time suck. But
yeah.
but I think that that's, you know, look, that's what happened. M.J. Rosenberg may embrace the term with open arms and mean Netanyahu first, but most of the others, you know, the cat bloggers, the Think Progress bloggers who use the term, back down from it. Actually,
they apologized for it.
They apologized for it because they felt that they actually hadn't really seen that it might have some sort of longer legs or some sort of historical negative association, and they didn't see it. And to be quite honest, I suspect it was used because it's almost like using an acronym on Twitter. You know, I think that it's
right.
I don't mean to excuse it, but I think that it's fast. People kind of basically get what you're trying to say, and that's, you know, what ends up happening on Twitter. You
right.
you go to some sort of like the quickest and, you know, shortest way of expressing yourself, and that's what this is.
Right. And as a long time and enthusiastic user of Twitter, I'll say that I think it's enormously valuable, not for arguing with people about stuff, but
mm-hmm.
finding out what people are writing about. And,
right.
you know, because when people, you know, there's lots of stuff I think I would miss, stuff that people are writing about or talking about if they weren't tweeting about it. Because there's only, you know, so many different ways you can get this information or links or whatever to come to you.
Right.
And so if you are strategic about choosing who you follow, you can find a lot of great information, which I think is something that I want to use to segue to your piece about 972.
Okay.
Because I think that some of what they do, the bloggers there, in terms of reporting things
mm-hmm.
that are happening on the ground in the West Bank or in Israel proper, is really interesting and valuable. I mean, way more valuable than arguments that take place on Twitter. And way more interesting to me than arguments that take place on Twitter. Because the way a lot of stuff from around the world gets reported in newspapers ordinarily, you do not get the same information that you might from somebody like some of the reporters who write for 972 who are tweeting and blogging about stuff that's happening.
Right. I think that there's, you know, 972 is part of the sort of social media citizen journalism revolution, although most of them are actually working journalists in their own right who write actually primarily in Hebrew, but some in English elsewhere, some in Arabic elsewhere, and about ways in which the medium is really well used. And I think you're right. I don't mean to bash Twitter altogether. I mean, I think I get great stuff off of Twitter that I would miss all the time. But the thing with 972 was it was a reach around the mainstream media. I mean, in the post-Second Intifada era, when Israelis were just traumatized and by the suicide bombings and sick of hearing about what was happening on the other side of the 67 borders and the so-called, you know, security wall went up, there was not a lot of conversation about what was happening in the West Bank, in the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. It was just people were sort of done with it. They didn't want to hear about it anymore. They didn't want to hear about atrocities taking place or soldiers that weren't acting well or, you know, suffering because they felt they'd suffered. And they had, you know, and I don't want to sound like they did not. And it was a terrible time to be in Israel during the Second Intifada. It was very scary to be there when you didn't know if you could go to a cafe or a restaurant or an ice cream shop without fear. That said, what 972 bloggers decided to do was to kind of pick up where mainstream journalism had necessarily dropped off, and partly because journalism in Israel, just like everywhere else in the world, is suffering economically. And so they placed their resources elsewhere to what their readers wanted and what was selling papers or what was selling television programs. What's interesting about what's happened is, and just like Twitter, is that 972 kind of being there on the ground at these Friday protests or the you know, every week there are protests in West Bank villages that protest the occupation, or who report again and again about ambulances that are stopped at checkpoints, or, you know, humiliations that take place in checkpoints, or even good things that happen, or culturally interesting things that happen. What ends up happening is that 972 reports on this, both in English, it does it in English, and it alerts the mainstream press. So what's happened is that you see that once 972, especially if they've written about something a fair amount, for example, the killing of a young Palestinian named Mustafa Tamimi in December in Nabi Saleh by an Israeli-fired tear gas canister. They wrote about it endlessly, and it got picked up by the New York Times lead blog, and all of a sudden a story that really probably would have gotten lost, it would have been a very, very, very short paragraph someplace that would have easily been kind of glossed over, became a much more international story. And this is the same thing that's happened with, you know, with other pieces.
The Arab Spring in general.
Right, exactly. Right. And I think that that's the use of it. I mean, I, you know, I was just on a panel at the Wilson Center the other day with Aaron David Miller and a couple of other people, someone from USIP, and we were talking about what the social media means for revolutions, and we were sort of arguing about is it obviously there have always been revolutions and social media didn't invent revolutions. At the same time, we've never had this opportunity to kind of reach past what were traditionally the interlocutors between us and what's happening, right? Mm-hmm. We have people now who serve as a new kind of eyes and ears, and some of, and you might call it journalism, and you might call it blogging, you might call it, I mean, but even looking at Syria with this sort of YouTube war that's taking place, I mean, we really know what's happening on the ground in Syria because they're broadcasting it in ways that is getting around the fact that it's almost impossible for journalists to get in there, or incredibly dangerous, as you've seen with the deaths of journalists.
Right, yes. Well, I think the thing that I was thinking about as I was digesting this whole episode with the Ben Smith article on CAV and Media Matters and thinking about the whole discussion that's played out on blogs and Twitters and blogs on, and Twitter about, you know, your use of language and policing the use of language and accusations that are thrown at people about being this or that, you know, being anti-Israel or being Israel first. Or, I mean, you know, but I mean, something that really struck me when I read your Nation piece in the context of all of that is that these are exactly the kind of stories that people, that in order to have a conversation among American progressive Jews, or even among Israeli Jews, that telling these stories is of crucial importance, far more, it's of far greater importance than these flame wars that take place on Twitter. Because it's only by understanding those stories that people can understand the reality of the occupation and the reality of what's happening in Israel without this sort of, these standoffs that happen with accusations thrown at people. And I think that that is, seems to me to be the greatest contribution coming out of this. Now, sometimes I think it's presented in a way that a lot of American Jews would just dismiss because of the way it's presented, that it's presented as being, they would read it as being anti-Israel. But right. I think that it's a start to at least tell the stories, which is, I think, the principal job of journalism, right?
Right.
So that these conversations can start to take place without all of this inflammatory language and these inflammatory accusations.
Look, I think that's right. I mean, I do think that 972 is still primarily read by progressive audience. I think there is a crowd that doesn't want to hear about it. It doesn't want to hear these things. And that's what a lot of commentators said to me on the ground in Israel. You know, the sort of mainstream mainstream Israeli journalists said people don't want to hear about it.
Israelis don't want to hear about it.
Israelis don't want to hear, but I'm not sure that Americans do either. I mean, it's very complicated. I mean, I think for me, you know, I was in Israel in August when I met with them, and I went on, I went to with Breaking the Silence to Hebron, which is a group of former IDF soldiers that take tours through what has happened to Hebron, the dividing of the city, and the kind of the term in Hebrew they use is cleansing. You know, they cleansed the former Arab market area, the Palestinian market area,
which is another word that has a very particular meaning.
Oh yeah, yeah, I mean, right. And they locked down the streets, so there are areas that only Jews can walk on and areas that Palestinians can walk on, and then there's a second city, you know, which is under Palestinian control. So there's area A and area B, and Israelis can't cross over into the Palestinian areas. But you see it, and it's just incredibly eerie and disturbing. And it, you know, I think that having grown up the way that I grew up it doesn't make me question the right of Israel in any way. It's just that it shows you that this situation is untenable and it can't continue. And I think that Palestine right, 2 really exposes some of that as well. And I think that that's very, very, very difficult for American Jews to hear. I think
a lot of it is in the presentation, because I think that sometimes, particularly in these truncated media like Twitter, that, sometimes it looks and sounds, the rhetoric sounds too binary. Like, well, the Israelis are in the wrong here, so that must mean that the, you know, Palestinians are blameless, right? And that's not, I mean, like, we have to get beyond that, okay? We can't, you know, you can't dissect every statement and every conversation as being about that. You have to be able to talk about the things that are actually happening without worrying about, oh, who are you blaming here? Or who are you not blaming here? Or who are you letting off as blameless here?
Right.
Because there's a reality that's affecting people's lives, literally their lives, you know, life and death. And I feel like, as a Jew, it goes against what I believe as a Jew to not have that conversation.
Right. No, of course. I mean, obviously, I mean, the point of, you know, you're supposed to be asking questions constantly and debating constantly in Jewish tradition. And look, I think that this is a very, it's obviously not black and white at all. You know, and I think that in the conversation I had with Gershon Gorenberg when I was reporting the 972 piece, and he made the point you just made, you know, not to say, well, now that we've decided the occupation is wrong, everything Israel does is wrong and everything the Palestinians do is right. That's not the takeaway. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, what I'd like to see is people coming away just feeling intensely confused and upset.
He wants people to be confused and upset.
Yeah. And uh-huh. I think that one of the bloggers for 972, this guy named Aziz Abusara, he actually kind of comes at it from the same perspective. He runs these dual narrative tours called Mejdi, and they take groups through Israel and the West Bank, and they have a Palestinian tour guide and an Israeli tour guide, and each of them present the story of each area or region or town or stone that they're standing on from both perspectives, and you can sort of see them running parallel but never intersecting, and that actually highlights as much as anything how deeply, you know, how difficult and entrenched the problem is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and this is beyond Iran and that kind of policy stuff, but this is more about the future of the occupation and two states and why it becomes so difficult to have this conversation in Israel or in the United States.
Right. Well, we are probably about past our time here. It's certainly not something we're going to resolve in the time we have anyway.
Yeah, no. And then we solve the Middle East crisis, right? conflict.
Well, listen, thanks so much for joining me again.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Okay, bye-bye.
See you soon. Bye.